Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series by Professor Judith Oakley, entitled Ethnographic Knowledge Has the Power to Transform. It may also be ignored, blocked, or misappropriated.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. It gives me great pleasure to welcome tonight a distinguished anthropologist. Judith Oakley has lectured at the universities of Essex and Durham. She was full professor at Edinburgh University and then became professor and chair of anthropology at Hull University. She is now deputy director of the International Gender Studies Center at the University of Oxford, from where she originally gained her DPhil. Judith Oakley has made significant contributions to at least five different areas of anthropology. Her original fieldwork was on gypsies in the United Kingdom, and she followed them around as travelers to their various camps. She made a point of trying to show that one could write a holistic monograph about gypsies, as well as one could write one about the many, many other peoples that social anthropologists have studied. To the present day, she is very involved in gypsy research and is internationally demanded for her contributions and continues to supervise many postgraduate students who are involved in studying gypsies. Secondly, Judith Oakley developed out of this concern with gypsies the importance of doing anthropology in your own country against the dominant trend in social anthropology worldwide. She has argued strongly that it is not necessary to do fieldwork in some far or distant place, but indeed one can see just how exotic and strange one's own society is and use anthropological method. This showed, if her first book was called The Traveler Gypsies, her second volume, Own
and,
or Other Country.
Which other is in, culture.
By Own or Other or Culture, other. Which is in the library, is much used by our students at the University of Malta and by students in other countries. Thirdly, Judith Oakley has made big contributions to feminist anthropology, to the development of our notions of the woman in anthropology, and to the importance of understanding how theories of embodiment can be applied in anthropology, not just in studying other people, but in trying to understand the anthropologist himself or herself in the work that they do. And this has shown up in many published articles. It also showed up in her volume, Simone de Beauvoir, a rereading published by Virago Press, because Judith is also very interested in contemporary French and feminist literature. Fourthly, these developments in her career led her to be a pioneer in developing reflexive anthropology. That is to say, developing the whole subdiscipline of anthropology in which people in studying other people realize and draw upon the incredible importance of their own social background. It is necessary to analyze their own social background in order to be able to better understand their interaction with whatever people they are studying. Fifthly and lastly, I would mention that now she is increasingly involved in visual anthropology and in ethnographic filmmaking, and is much involved in judging ethnographic films at various festivals and competitions. So with that all too inadequate introduction, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Judith Oakley, who has been here now. This is her fourth visit to Malta to teach anthropology students, and we very much look forward to her paper because she wishes to publish this paper, and she looks forward to your feedback. Judith, welcome.
Thank you. This is a repeat of my Eric Wolff lecture that I was honored to give in Vienna in October I was somewhat inhibited by the fact that the person who gave the first Eric Wolf lecture was Marshall Sahlins. So I thought, why, this is a hard act to follow. Anyway, when I was in Vienna, I said it was a pity that I couldn't speak German and deliver it, because my parents had actually, as English people, had met in Berlin and were fluent in German. But I'm delighted to be invited back to Malta, because I was born here and my second name is Melita. So I have, you know, and it's always nice when you come back and they look at your passport and it says birthplace, Valletta. So the title of my lecture is Ethnographic Knowledge Has the Power to Transform. It may also be ignored, blocked, or misappropriated. And I'll talk a bit about what I think is ethnographic knowledge. Then I'll show how it was used to influence government policy. We had an earlier discussion today about whether applied anthropology was real anthropology. I was first involved in a policy-oriented project, and my contribution actually changed for a brief while government policy, but then with the rise of Thatcherism and John Major, all that ethnographic knowledge was discarded, and the ethnographic knowledge was ignored and produced a new crisis towards the gypsies. Ethnographic knowledge emerges from practice and brings a very different perspective from other routes to knowledge. I'll outline key aspects of this practice before demonstrating how it transforms taken-for-granted assumptions. The UK state's policies towards gypsies was for a brief period influenced by the results of ethnographic research, but was cast aside because of the changed political agenda. I use the title Gypsies, not Roma, because this is what the people themselves use to describe themselves. There are other groups who call themselves Roma and think that gypsies is not adequate, but I am using the term which the people use themselves. I didn't go around telling them you've got to call yourselves Roma. Eric Wolf declares that anthropology is a mode of knowledge like no other, and flows in part from the anthropological insistence on observation. The power of ethnographic knowledge is based on participant observation, regardless of locations, sites, and continents. Such knowledge can transform understanding of varied human possibilities. It can empower persecuted minorities, or it can expose the abuse of power. It's not neutral in practice. With potential for enlightenment, it may be cast aside. It risks being blocked when studying up, or appropriated when politically expedient. In my field research, amongst both gypsies and the representatives of the non-gypsy surrounding society, which are called Gadje or Gorjo, I followed most of the practices I outline. This produced very different perspectives than by other standardized non-anthropological methods. The historical context of the anthropological tradition commenced with an open-ended approach, and some of the students have heard this over and over again in the last 10 days, where there was likely to be little documentation. Anthropologists couldn't start with advanced hypotheses. They had to be flexible and open to the unpredictable. Alternative approaches may depend on a pilot study. When research depends on an advanced questionnaire, few changes can be made when delegated. Since no advanced agenda could be fixed, pioneer anthropologists were open to studying a holistic entirety, the politics, the economy, the religion, or ritual and kinship. Today, other aspects have been included, such as gender or interrelations. Moreover, holism need not be limited to functionalist studies. The holistic method has proved uniquely appropriate in the study of any society. From armchair to veranda to tent to tarmac, that is the progress of anthropology. There's been a struggle between a perceived need for scientific legitimation, which disintegrated into scientistic positivism and a wider interpretation of science as knowledge. Methods move from Fraser's armchair to the tent to shared residence and participant observation. This has proved relevant to any context, non-Western or Western, rural or urban. My fieldwork was conducted while residing in a caravan on gypsy encampments near the main motorway exit from London, 25 miles away. And that was my caravan, one of my caravans, right near the M1, the major exit from London. I call that tarmacadam anthropology. Field sites may be selective fragments, but still in contrast to the sample-led directives of the structured questionnaire. The emphasis is on multi-contextual as opposed to unidimensional contacts. The anthropologist comes to fieldwork with a cross-cultural mental archive of ethnographies from around the globe. She or he may have to switch emphasis either on arrival or mid-flow according to the concerns discovered or generated by the people themselves. The anthropologist is disponible, to use Breton's term, available, open to serendipity. In extensive dialogues with leading anthropologists on how they actually experienced fieldwork in my forthcoming book, I find transgression of orthodoxies and fieldwork as discovery and risk. Research draws on the unexpected rather than mechanistic procedures. Anthropologists had to follow what the people themselves prioritized. Ethnographic practice involves responding to what is there, not what the funder nor the field worker wish to find. Ethnographic knowledge emerges from being there and learning from the people as subjects, not objects. Unexpected events point to hidden power structures, or what Eric Wolf would call forces rather than architectural metaphors. This conflicts with the hypothesis-led scientism which has plagued quantitative social sciences. Participant observation. Experiential approaches contrast with instrumental techniques. Ethnographic knowledge is not reducible to people merely talking to each other, and unfortunately the word ethnography has been appropriated by other disciplines, as Marilyn Strathern regrets, and has been reduced to people just talking to each other. Nor can it be reduced to discourse analysis. Positivism remains embedded in much social science empirical research. A hierarchical structure separates research directors from the data gatherers beneath in those sort of traditions. Ideas men formulate the agenda, rarely encountering the research subjects. As emphasis is placed on metric worth, grant holders act as line managers. Discovery is replaced by delivery. Textbooks proclaim a participant observation continuum with a fictive extreme from observer to participant. These are not separable. Observation should not be conflated with inactivity. In order to observe, the anthropologist needs to participate. The anthropologist learns rather than dictates the agenda. He or she is in a position to give voice to the hitherto unheard. The anthropologist learns the language, or she adjusts to the dialect and the linguistic nuances. Here's a picture, if you still recognize me, of me in the field in the 70s. I'm the one on the left. My supervisor, Godfrey Leonhardt, said, which one is the gypsy? And also, as I've explained to the people in my class, I had to adjust my language. I didn't have to learn another language, but I had to learn to speak different. I had to drop me H's and extend me vowels and talk about motors and lorries and gathers and all that sort of thing. And have you got any old rags, things like that. Now, she met me when I was first in the field, and she said, Judith, I do like the way you speak. You've had special elocution lessons. I wish I could learn to speak like that. And I thought, there's something hypocritical here. I know I'm stuck with a boarding school accent. Anyway, she went off travelling, and then after a while she came back, and I learnt to talk a bit like this, you see, ever so casual. And she said, "Judith, your speech has improved." here's another of my camps that I lived on. As you can see there, there's the bit of a motorway exit. We were right near a motorway, and it was near an entrance to a major town, and the councillor who came and visited me, he thought anthropologists were people who looked at skulls, and he said, you better not tell them that you're an anthropologist. He thought I'd get out my tape measure and sort of measure their skulls and the lengths of their noses. Anyway, he said we can't possibly have a site there because it makes a bad entrance to the city, and that was demolished, like the other one I showed you. Positionality. Subjective sensitivity undermines the ghost of the distant observer. The consequences of the race, gender and age of the field worker and associates with whom the field worker establishes relationships are now commonly addressed. But there's also bodily and unconscious knowledge. Interest in the senses, a new journal is called The Senses, has come out, is increasingly placed in the context of hitherto unarticulated practices. This is embodied knowledge, and already the students have seen this picture. It's rather badly reproduced. It's in my book, Anthropology and Autobiography. But, you know, I posed with a gypsy woman who agreed to be photographed by a solicitor and her companion. I knew the photographer. Beatrice didn't. She consented, but what I found fascinating when I looked at that picture months later is that I've imitated her bodily barrier. I hadn't imitated the open perspective of the photographer who I knew. I have unconsciously absorbed her hesitancy, and I've reflected it in my body. Sensual kinetic approaches contrast with the structured questionnaire, where emphasis is on operationalization, suggesting the field is to be conquered rather than surrendered to. The structured interview is a Western cultural paradigm of detachment without reciprocity. By contrast, shared knowledge and experience make for dialogue. Anthropology has long moved from the ahistorical stereotype of research without use of written records, although, as Eric Wolf recognises, we may engage with a people without recorded history. He wrote a famous book on that subject. Experience of living people aids the interpretation of written fragments about their antecedents. Ethnographic material includes visual records whose potential and the problematization of reading them needs confronting. Analysis is both highly organized and creatively vague. Given the material has been cross-checked through many contexts over time, significant numerical and utterly accurate tables may emerge. The sample may be small but is profound. A single stray remark may unlock an entire system. The anthropologist finds commonalities and consistencies in human agency, or what Wolf calls forces. Unlike the functionist who found only harmony, the material may reveal disjunction and contradictions, again something which Eric Wolf studied. The political economy as well as ideology can be analysed and exposed. Ultimately, the aim is to reveal alternative ways of being in the world and the full range of human possibilities. The major concern in anthropology has been to elicit respect through analysis. By contrast, in political espionage, where the participant infiltrator is on the payroll of the powerful, the aim is less to give voice to the subjects than to comprehend the system to control or to destroy it. And I say that there are fascinating contrasts or similarities between espionage and participant observation. The spy masters don't say before they send the spy in, "Have you got your hypothesis?" Before becoming an anthropologist, I had ethnographic experience, albeit fragmented, without fully recognised it. There were resonances with Eric Wolf's interest in peasants. This was with rural farming peoples in the west of Ireland. Through knowledge as practice, I was drawn into anthropology. I went as honorary wife of a social scientist. This was alternative anti-consumerist living in the late 60s. There was relative poverty, but my closest associates, mainly women, were inspirational in their ingenuity on their farms, in their own pub and with local food production. None of the women I befriended in the west of Ireland wanted to live elsewhere. They chose to remain in their rural locations. They drew me into their lives. We stayed in their homes and participated in their labour. I brought in the turf or the peat, having loaded it on the donkey. I helped make haystacks and I served drinks behind the bar. These were not rural isolates. They had relatives in the UK and the US. There was movement back and forth, now recognised as diasporic. When we, my honorary husband and I, offered a lift to several men in Connemara, they revealed that they'd built the London Victoria Underground line. Where my then partner's single authored book presented only decay and demoralization, I saw survival strategies, continuity and autonomy. I was thus confronted with positionality. Then after my work with gypsies, I was asked to do some research in Normandy, a comparative study with Britain. And I met Madame Gregoire, a woman, again, the students have seen this. She was president of the local Old People's Society. I met her when she was plucking a chicken. And after a while, she said, j'ai du travail à faire. And so she went out to milk the cows, and I said, could I join her? And the eyebrows went up. And then after a while, I said, could I have a go milking cows? Eyebrows went up again. And she introduced me to a very mild cow called Mère Nono, who didn't kick, unlike this one who needed a metal bar to stop her kicking. And she said, attendez, I'll come back. I was pulling helplessly away at these teats of this cow. Nothing came out. But Madame Gregoire came back and took a photograph of me. So I love that, that the studied person is photographed by the so-called informant. And we became very close. Indeed, I mean, she sort of treated me like a sort of honorary daughter. People said in the village that I was destined to be the fiancé of her son, which didn't happen. Anyway, research and policy, government research. Government regularly uses information from the secret services. This is not rejected on the grounds of positivistic social science criteria. Instead, for strategic political priorities. While ethnography has been unfavorably contrasted with generalizations from numerical mass, such judgments become irrelevant for intra- or interstate conflict. The use of anthropology and its methods has been suggested for appropriation by the US state under Project Camelot many years ago. Ethnographies have been devastatingly scrutinized for military purposes. It was said that they were examined as to when the labor force was out in the fields, as to when it was convenient to bomb Vietnam. Ethnographies have been thus devastatingly misused. Covert participation is prioritized for intelligence. Hence, recent US state-sponsored recruitment drives for anthropologists to work for the CIA and published in the American Anthropological Association database. At the AAA this November, a speaker revealed that the US military are now looking to British anthropology for cultural guidance. And I sort of wave my thing saying Oxford anthropology. Already it was discovered that the British Foreign Office made a less than transparent donation of funding to research councils in Britain last year to study counterinsurgency. And this was not properly publicised, and there was a huge Fortunately, the anthropologists were the most outspoken about this. It is no coincidence that the anthropologist is often mistaken for a spy. The methods have similarities. The anthropologist or spy does not perform ostentatiously as inquirer. She learns the language, co-resides and participates. The crucial difference is the anthropologist acquires knowledge not for betrayal, but for humanist illumination and potential empowerment. Studying up also results in transformation. The relation between the state, political power and research takes various forms. First, anthropology is espionage. In Project Camelot, the relation between the state's covert colonialist agenda and the potential work of anthropologists was undisguised. The project was eventually exposed and discredited by Eric Wolff and others. Here the state set the agenda. Anthropologists were to explore insurgents against US interests, especially in South America. Embedded or independent research, public servant as paid policy advisor. Where government or policy makers set the agenda in public and with transparency, matters may be more benign. Paymasters elicit and retain the knowledge. Representatives of government have the power to control and sometimes undermine the researchers, their adjuncts. Where policy orientation oriented research is under ministerial direction, the advanced agenda is invariably fixed. But another kind, independent but state-funded research councils, here the state may still put informal pressure as to its agenda, not necessarily for crude anti-democratic and military aims, but avowedly utilitarian ones. The EU has proven an increasingly significant source of research funding. Here the anthropologist's ingenuity may be rewarded, and I'm delighted to be associated with a Marie Curie research project which empowers Roma postgraduates throughout Central Europe, and I shall be lecturing in Budapest in July. Thirdly, charitable research trusts. Where knowledge is acquired independently of state paymasters, there is a greater possibility of a flexible agenda. The ethnographic method can expose the mechanics of power. The most intellectually productive research can be that conducted by funding bodies not beholden to state pressure. Some charitable trusts draw wealth from large business enterprises. Roundtree Chocolate was ultimately the source of my first research on gypsies. Ethnographic knowledge incorporated, then discarded. In this lecture, I consider a case study of government policy towards gypsies. At first, ethnographic research changed a 1970s Labour government policy from near enforced assimilation to recognition and provision for cultural and ethnic difference. The result of a co-authored ethnographic study, which I was co-author, convinced a then broadly liberal-minded Labour government. But the authenticity can be cast aside in a changed political climate. As Wolff recognised, power balances continually shift and change. The subsequent Conservative government, elected in 1979 under Margaret Thatcher, was to reject this grounded knowledge. I've watched helplessly as the consequences of the abolition of the 1968 Caravan Sites Act by John Major's government in 1994 has developed in both predictable and innovative ways. The legislative rejection of provision for difference still sustained under New Labour has precipitated a more dramatic crisis than decades earlier. This was made visible in the Conservative Party 2004 election campaign that I will be talking about in briefly. How does ethnographic knowledge produce a different text and one written by government representatives? Contrast the 1967 ministerial report based on the first official census of gypsies and travellers in England and Wales with the subsequent ministerial report 10 years later in 77, where the author, Cripps, acknowledges the influence of our ethnographic study. The first ministerial report was based on a questionnaire with data from 3,500 families. The second was based on long-term ethnographic participant observation and dialogues producing material for only 125 known families, all known in depth. The earlier 1965 census, which collected the material for 3,500 families, was conducted by officials, including the police. The analysis depended on secondary sources, armchair judgments, and random experts, in inverted commas. The limited questions contain many presumptions, for example, that an individual had only one present occupation. The questions said, give your main occupation, and there was no room for the fact that gypsies have multi-occupations. And for a nomadic group, a single reason had to be given to the question, why did you travel? The minister's foreword revealed assimilationist presumptions, and this is what some of it said, if you can read it here. This is the first comprehensive study in the country of the life and problems of minority group. Notice gypsy with a small g. The world around them has altered so rapidly their roving life can no longer be carried on without hardship. The travellers' way of life and their attitude to amenities in both town and country clash with those of most other people. House dwellers often find that unlawful encampments are a squalid nuisance. The fact that many travellers are illiterate adds to their difficulties in a complex, increasingly urbanised society, limits their understanding of a more settled way of life. Children are apt to suffer most. Interestingly, a Indian anthropologist read some of this. She read a draft of this, and she said she couldn't believe some of these quotes. They echoed the sort of development ethnocentricity that she found in her own country and around the world, and she was astonished that the Brits were doing it about their own culture. The ministers highlighted the travellers' nuisance value through squalor, their alleged ignorance, their apparent isolation. Children were seen as the prime victims. Although the report implied ignorance of urbanisation, the census showed 43% of the caravan-dwelling population lived in south-east England following the concentration of the non-gypsy population. A further 17% were recorded in a region noted for heavy industry. In rural concentrations, the gypsies provided casual seasonal work, therefore only one of other probable occupations. Here's another quote from that report. Patronising. One measure of the social isolation of the gypsies is the survival among them of the Romani language, many dialects of which have been recorded in Europe and elsewhere. This was also signed, this report, by the Minister for Wales. Would he have said an example of isolation was that many Welsh people still spoke Welsh? I don't know. No account is taken of the gypsies' continuing ingenuity in adapting to changes in the larger economy. Most are illiterate, ill-informed of the world around them, and tend to be resistant to new ideas. Absolute, you know, it's a wonderful sort of red rag to my bull. Yet the report revealed the dramatic shift to motor-drawn caravans from horse-drawn wagons and their use of television. The report is inconsistent. Gypsy children are said to be quick to acquire certain skills and can recognise and separate different metals, can distinguish valuable from useless rags. Sometimes the older boys of school age accompany their fathers on the lorries. Do you think we could... Oh, we do have the door open, that's right. I just thought it was terribly hot in here, but anyway. Is it possible to open a window? Thank you. So the older boys, etc., etc., many are adept at handling money and playing cards. You know, where is the ignorance there? But in the next paragraph, we are informed As the family is almost the only socialising influence experienced by the traveller child in his formative years, his intellectual growth tends to be inhibited by lack of stimulating experience. Improved education alone cannot solve the problems, etc., etc. Simultaneous action is needed by the authorities responsible for employment, industrial training, housing and planning. So you see all the assimilation, ethnocentric agenda. And there they are, the range of work skills among the Setu population has greatly extended since the Industrial Revolution. The traveller by his mode, etc., is still restricted to a very limited range of occupations. And yet their very question has said, what is your main occupation? They hadn't even bothered to ask what their multiple occupations were. The image on the cover appealed presumably to the sort of sentimentality of the reader, gypsies and other travellers, children they thought would be innocent victims of an alien culture from which they needed to be rescued, worthy of compassion and ripe for assimilation. They were seen as wild. The report endorses the earlier Plowden report that they are probably the most severely deprived children in the country. Improved education alone cannot solve the problems of these children. Simultaneous action is needed by the authorities responsible for employment, industrial training, etc. I showed that in the overhead. And then they talked about the limited skills and everything else. And then they mentioned the scrap metal dealers. They admitted, I mean, you know, they have adjusted to industrialization. They were recycling scrap metal. There are some gypsies in Romania who are near multimillionaires, recycling the old communist factories, exporting it to China. It is possible that most travelers will see scrap dealing after education and permanent housing have had their effect on future. So again and again, you see this assimilation agenda which does not appreciate their brilliance at adapting to change in the larger economy, and so it goes on. It does discussion of the importance of scrap metal for the steel and non-ferrous industries actually reveal that the annual turnover in 1965 for such things was £250 million, which the gypsies contributed to. The report was published, made available to the public. It had some beneficial effects. It triggered the Caravan Sites and Control of Development Act, making it a duty for some local authorities to provide sites for gypsies. However, key councils were exempted and caravan pitches for urban councils were restricted to 15. So regardless of the census returns, people could only have 15 plots in urban areas. The Act was considered controversial, and so controversial that the Labour government would not even take responsibility for pushing it through. As with the legislation for abortion and homosexuality, it was officially labelled a private member's bill and given to a Liberal Party MP. Despite its seemingly benign nature, unique and discriminatory powers were given to the police to evict all remaining gypsies from an area once a site had been provided. So once a site was provided for 15, regardless of the population on the census, there were ruthless powers. Arrests could be made without warrants. Caravans could be confiscated. People could be imprisoned. The report's main author, Barbara Adams, a civil servant, worried that the wishes of the gypsy travellers had not been fully considered. She courageously gained secondment from the Ministry of Housing to conduct research at an independent centre. The project gained funding from the Roundtree Memorial Trust. This is where I came to be employed as a researcher. At first, my employer privileged the questionnaire with vast sets of quantitative tables, but she was eventually won over, after the in-depth material emerged from intensive fieldwork, which I had to fight for at every turn. Participant observation exposed systematic formations and conveyed the inside perspective. There are different results for the spy who is tracking subversive conspiracy. The reward for the anthropologist is becoming intellectually and empathetically tuned to the people's concerns, then theorized on a wider plane. I conducted neoclassical fieldwork, living as co-resident and going out to work with the gypsies. My co-researchers, non-anthropologists on this project, who only worked part-time and intermittently, did not live on encampments. They accumulated basic material, three of them, for 50 families through day visits. I consolidated material for 75 families. My chapters outlined the larger system of the political economy, travelling, family units and kinship. My material derived solely from Southeast England. Long-term participant observation gave a holistic perspective. I disentangled the notion of the real full-blooded gypsy from the principle of descent, demonstrated that geographical flexibility was integral to their economy, which favoured multi-occupations and a resistance to wage labour. Wealth was not necessarily associated with literacy. I found some of the wealthiest gypsies were non-literate, and one of them actually asked me to teach him how to read and write. The vast majority did not seek assimilation, but preferred semi-autonomy as an ethnic group. The findings of our study were published as a co-authored book. This one here, Gypsies and Government Policy in England. By the mid-70s, although, you see, the ministry had actually tried to stop our research because they thought it would be too benign and too friendly to the gypsies, but by the mid-70s they were embarrassed about the number of questions asked in the House of Commons. The Labour government sought a detailed report on the implementation of that earlier act, and they appointed a member of the establishment, John Cripps, to conduct an inquiry. Here, the production of ethnographic knowledge suddenly produced or provided an important resource for the very same ministry that tried to stop our research. Now politically expedient, the findings of our book, with its systematic gypsy perspective, had a major influence on the Cripps report. The minister, one Peter Shaw, fully endorsed it. By the way, his son is professor of anthropology in New Zealand, Peter Shaw.
And a former lecturer here.
There we are. This was the report by John Cripps, Accommodation with the Ministry cover. Cripps lifted many of our ideas and cited authors without reference. I now learn that both in journalism and in politics, you lift and you plagiarize without any problems. Even novelists like McEwan can get away with it. My use of Frederick Barth's notion of self-ascription was instrumental by Cripps for the definition of a gypsy in his report. Here, ethnographic knowledge and anthropology was used constructively for political ends. The author did decently acknowledge our, although he plagiarized Barth and everything else, he did acknowledge, and you know, I'm quite proud of that. It has not been possible for me in the allotted time to investigate the origins of gypsies, nor to study it firsthand and in depth their way of life. In any event, I could not have added usefully to the findings of Barbara Adams and others, whose careful and sympathetic study was published as recently as 75. Their book provided me with a valuable introduction, and nothing I have seen or heard has caused me to doubt the substantial accuracy of their findings. He didn't say there's only 125 in your sample. And then, contrary to all that assimilation policy that you heard ad infinitum. This is what he said. Whatever the previous policies, the secretaries of state now accept the gypsy's right to a nomadic existence for so long as he wishes to continue it. There is no intention to put pressure on him to settle or assimilate unless he wishes to do so, which was a triumph of anthropology. Finally, the grounded ethnography put a convincing case for A, the recognition of the gypsies as an ethnic group, the viability of their informal geographically and occupational flexibility interlinked with the dominant economy, the recognition the majority were not seeking assimilation via housing and wage labour. Gypsy travellers needed legally recognised camping land with possibilities for both movement and settlement, either on rented or purchased land. Planning permission for nomads. Although, therefore, the 68 Act had its defects, it had made it obligatory to provide official sites. But John Major's Conservative government, later in the 1994 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act, with just a minor clause, you know, it was all about New Age travellers and people smashing up lorries or something, and then with one minor a clause, they abolished the obligation for council to provide any sites for gypsies, paving the way for the long-term crisis in traveller accommodation. The new legislation was steered through Parliament by one Michael Howard, later to become Home Secretary and then leader of the Conservative opposition just 2 years ago. For all its faults, the earlier 68 Act was a crucial recognition of gypsies as a caravan-dwelling group. But in 94, it was said that gypsies should be encouraged henceforth to buy their own land and apply for planning permission. Notice, you'll remember, you'll see that as a refrain later. There is total hostility for nomads to have planning permission for caravans on land. It's very difficult enough to get planning permission to buy land and then have a house on it because of the green belt and all that. But for caravans, they're seen as eyesores and temporary accommodation. It was archly suggested special consideration should be given to gypsies' applications, but gypsies, New Age travellers and academics like myself lobbied outside the House of Commons, and here was one of the lobbying things that we had: government proposals to hound gypsies and other travellers out of existence. Come and hear about it at a Liberty meeting, the House of Commons. Lobby your MP about proposals. That was, I joined in. It was great, very inspiring seeing New Age travellers, academics, travellers, hundreds of people. The Conservative minister in the House of Lords nonetheless declared, "It is the government's view that public provision has now reached a satisfactory level, that further provision should be made by the gypsies themselves through the planning system." Official report, 1994. Well, all the problems that we suggested came true. Gypsies then found that sites were run down. They couldn't, there was no allowance for them to have planning permission. They bought land, they tried everything. What is so fascinating for me is the ingenious way in which travellers have found new ways of surviving. What they've done, in large clusters, they have bought land, often cheaper set-aside agricultural land, where there isn't planning permission either for housing or caravans. They've employed solicitors. Overnight, in Sleepy Hollow, people have woken up to find maybe 50 caravans moved onto land. They have tarmacked it, they've asked for electricity and everything else. And this is the sort of thing, remember the sites where I lived, this is now, what was the date of that, March 2005. 2 years ago. Of course, I, as an anthropologist, would love to know all about the politics and the kinship. Huge solidarity had to be arranged for those people. They employed solicitors, they bought the land. But of course, then there were court cases and newspapers came up with these sort of things. Stamp, there's the sun. Stamp on the camps to stop flood of gypsies. Kin group intercooperation produced those sort of things. And then the 2005 Conservative Party electoral campaign included the following advertisement. This is what Michael Howard put his name to. This is the man who steered through the abolition of that act. I believe in fair play. The same rules should apply to everyone. I don't believe in special rules. This was full page advert in The Independent on Sunday and other newspapers. We are all British. We are one nation. Too many people today seem to think they don't have to play by the rules. They're using the so-called human rights to get away with doing the wrong thing. If you want to build a new home, you have to get planning permission first. But if you're a traveller, you can bend the planning law, building where you like, thanks to the Human Rights Act. It was deliberate, sort of. This is, by the way, the son of an illegal immigrant. That's Michael Howard, the son of an illegal immigrant. He believes in British fair play. It's not fair that there's one rule for travellers and another for everyone else. This is one of the reasons why the Conservative Party is reviewing the Human Rights Act. If it can't be improved, we'll scrap it. Fairness matters. British needs a government that stops people using human rights. You know, I see that kind of hysteria. It's very, very disturbing. And so I watch, as I said. I was part of a group that changed government policy. We could have predicted what happened. And the Labour government is too timid to... they're trying lots of things underhand, but they're not really doing anything. So there's the end of that second part of my discussion. I'm now just going to move on finally to... And we didn't start till 15:15. Ethnographic knowledge in the media. So I'm moving on to how one can interpret the media images from an ethnographic perspective. Just as quantitative research may be countered by in-depth ethnographic knowledge, so can media images captured by photojournalists. Ethnographic knowledge can, like thick description, as Geertz says, make sense of or transform comprehension, seeing into the values and priorities of the people themselves, albeit via the gaze of the anthropologist. The photojournalist may record technically perfect images without understanding the content. Ethnographic knowledge can make new or alternative sense of images, often selected and constructed with a Euro-American ethnocentric eye. Grounded interpretation of images may also be deliberately ignored by the media in an appeal to the presumed values of a wider hegemony. Images can be appropriated for destructive as well as humanitarian ends. Just as I think that overall picture of the gypsy sites to me is ethnographically fascinating, but it was presented for quite different reasons. Grounded knowledge brings new or counter sense. I pursue multiple meanings in photographs associated with the gypsies, mainly from newspaper offices in my fieldwork locality, taken within broadly the same time span under persons I knew. I didn't turn up with a camera. It was fairly unusual anyway. Cameras were associated with journalists who were invasive, but by some extraordinary chance, I discovered that there were obviously some very dedicated photojournalists in my field area who were taking amazing photographs, and I went to the archive. Like the census interviewers, it is likely the photojournalists encountered the travellers in limited encounters. They have aesthetic framing and perfect focus, with a universalistic or exoticized agenda. Other photos emphasize disorder and a sedentarist, non-nomadic aesthetic. On the other hand, the anthropologist brings ethnographic knowledge unavailable to the photojournalist, whose photographs, now with global power and implications, may carry contrary or surplus meanings. I've had to cut out a lot of my references to theoreticians on this. Haastrup provocatively suggests the photographic image is comparable to Geertz's thin description and inferior to the text, which is comparable to thick description. I argue that the visual is more subtle than a monolithic critique of ocular centricism. There's a difference between the panopticon gaze and the engaged act of seeing, which involves in-depth knowledge. I distinguish between looking and seeing. Non-anthropologists' images. These may privilege some believed universalism or humanity. Photojournalists go for the big themes such as conflict, famine, suffering, glamour, joy, or grief. They are conveyed through a specific icon. What Haastrup suggests should be the work of the text, I suggest can be the work of the ethnographer. The ethnographer's knowledge transcends the iconography created by the outsider. The alternative interpretation rests on long-term interaction with the subjects. Whereas the anthropologist brings ethnographic knowledge, the journalist brings prior ideographic baggage. We can compare this humanistic baggage and covert rigidity to the fixed agenda of positivistic social science. The mass media privileges the dominant Euro-American ideology. The photographic image may be variously interpreted, of course, by viewers from different cultures, and the ideal would be to have continuous access to the indigenous interpretation of globally circulated images. The anthropologist, if not an indigenous member, is an intermediary. The indigenous subjects of the images will have unique and detailed interpretations. But unfortunately, the people that I lived with are scattered, moved, grown up, moved on, passed away. But ethnographic knowledge may also point to hidden systematic themes. I use Roland Barthes' distinction between the studium and the punctum. He introduces the word studium to cover the general and immediately comprehensible aspects of a photograph, what he calls an extension of a field, which I perceive as a consequence of, he says, my knowledge, my culture. The second element he labels is a punctum, a wound or a mark made by a pointed instrument. Some photographs are, Barthes says, speckled with sensitive points. This disturbs the studium. A photograph's punctum is that accident which pricks. To recognize the studium is inevitably to encounter the photographer's intentions, but always to understand them. Barthes' use of punctum, for him, is personal and idiosyncratic. It is a detail, a mark in portraits. He points to perhaps a laced boot, a necklace, an incongruous gesture in photographs. But I wish to transform Barthes' two elements to a cross-cultural perspective. I say the studium is the equivalent to the monocultural Euro-American comprehension. Barthes locates the studium within culture, but doesn't specify that this is his French, westernized comprehension. His recognition of a punctum is a subjective reaction. But I apply the notion of punctum to cultural recognition, but one which interrupts and subverts the photographer's taken-for-granted studium. The intention of the photojournalist clashes with the ethnographic leakage in the scene and ensuing image. Ethnographic knowledge detects the countercultural. I was first alerted to the disjunction between the expert eye of a celebrated national professional photographer and me, the anthropologist, when I asked a famous photographer for permission to reproduce his photograph of a gypsy trailer interior in my book. That was taken by Homer Sykes. I was especially keen because the image showed the continuous formica top here, there, without a sink. And just the bowl, which would be washing for the crockery. As we rang off, I just said, I particularly like that because it doesn't have a sink. And he was astounded. And he said, oh, I hadn't noticed. I didn't know there wasn't a sink. He didn't know about the pollution beliefs concerning sinks. To the anthropologist, the punctum was the conspicuously displayed stainless steel washing up bowl, something which this brilliant photographer hadn't noted. He didn't know the culture. Photographs of gypsy children feature widely in journalist representations, as seen in that cover of the 1967 report. You know, they're innocent. Children are innocent. They couldn't help being born into a certain culture, so we must rescue them. What few journalists and others fail to recognize is that gypsies' perceived innocence is their power. They're the first to run out and investigate strangers, then report back to the adults. That report showed the photograph of gypsy children. Also, they showed inside that 67 report a photograph of gypsies playing. And I think it was, you know, gypsies are the most deprived in the country. But what I see in that picture is not deprivation, but adventure playground and the acquisition of knowledge. Gypsy children learn to discriminate different types of scrap metal. They play around. This is preparation and imitation for future work. Gypsy children off-sites may not be easily recognized. However, one alert photographer in my field area captured the sight, this sight of a young girl on a roundabout with either policeman or traffic warden pushing a pram with a sack of smokeless fuel, negotiating a roundabout. Obviously, the photographer was astounded. That was his punctum. She was the outsider's punctum, not that of the anthropologist. Another photo from the archives shows the children of my closest ally watching the bulldozing of one of those sites where I lived. This is because the local councillor had informed me and others it was in sight of their cathedral city and created a bad impression. I add my own ethnographic comments on the politicization of children, who those for years were ordered by the council to pick up every toffee paper, only to see it turned into a derelict wasteland. There's the politicization of children. Funerals are also a major site for journalists to portray gypsies outside their encampment. This one, I attended this funeral. I've mentioned it before in my lectures. When I showed it to, in a paper I gave as a postgrad in Oxford, Wendy James, the anthropologist there, she pondered the punctum, the paradox of the wreath in the form of a chair for a nomadic peoples, the theme of chairs. And she said, you know, how come chairs for people who move? And that really stimulated me to pursue the transformation of a nomad into a sedentarized, seated and fixed non-being after death. Gypsies have to settle after death. Access. The context of the photojournalist's presence is often crucial. Access may need to be through an official. This appears to be the case in the photograph of a relatively deprived group a family group there, you know, in a rather beaten up old caravan. In this image, the photographer has privileged the clutter and rubbish in the foreground, but the punctum for me is the briefcase inadvertently at the edge of the frame, which I conclude belongs not, of course, to a non-literate group, but to the accompanying non-gypsy bureaucrat, presumably off-camera. The most dramatic aspect is the gaze of the young boy fixated on the briefcase. What the journalist and the Gorgio official do not know is that gypsy children in my field area were repeatedly told that the devil was a man with a briefcase. Thus, a mirror image of the tales of gypsies stealing non-gypsy children is that which represents the Gorgio official as a child thief. Many gypsy children in the past were indeed taken from their parents and placed forcibly into care. Absences. There are telling absences in the journalist archive. There are very few interiors of the trailer caravans. There was one of that woman who said, "Your speech has improved." She was very accessible. She was married to a man who'd been brought up in a council house and was literate. She was very open. That was quite unusual for her to allow somebody inside. There are almost no work photos. Since the gypsy's economy privileges self-employment with multi-occupations, it is less visible. There's an absence of images of adult men in the local archives. They're vulnerable to official controls through identification. The main contexts where journalists have access are in large ritual gatherings such as the Epsom races, and that's indeed where Homer Sykes took that photograph of the interior of the caravan. The people consented for him to come inside. They were untraceable. Here the ethnographer can explain the crowded presence of men in images at the fairs because they're away from their traceable travelling grounds, so they consent to being photographed. So I went to the National Journalist Archives and I found photographs of people I knew, and that was taken at Derby Day. This is the man that was really wealthy. He asked me to teach him how to read and write. All I had was sort of Lady Bird and Jack and Jill stories. It was really embarrassing. In the end, he learnt to do his signature, but he didn't need me. He didn't need literacy. I mean, after weeks of me going up there every night to do things, to show him how to read these Jack and Jill books, he sort of gave up, but he learnt the signature. And my goodness, you don't mess with that lot. They are the toughest fighters. It's very interesting that he consented to be photographed there. A number of photographs by journalists are, as I said, of men at national events. Other absences are photographs of interrelations with non-gypsies. I found some revealing photos in the local collection. This was one where this family had blockaded the entrance to a new site that had been built because they felt that they hadn't been given rights of ownership, of tenancy. There was a conflicting priority. The local authority went by what they called physical economic need, whereas for the gypsies it was kinship. And I talked to local officials, and for them, kinship was nepotism. So this woman, Bomber, you don't mess with Bomber, she confronted the official, and here he is holding his official papers. Another photograph I found in the archives, I said again, I knew these people, was what appears to be a real gypsy woman with sort of, I think she's got curlers or a headscarf, she's got earrings, she's got all sorts of trappings of a real Carmen figure. She is a non-gypsy. She's one of these Gorgio non-gypsy wives who married to a gypsy, like many, they have chosen to be more exotically gypsy and act as informed intermediaries. Having lived both sides of the ethnic line, they have the heightened awareness of difference and its public performance. My own photographs. I did take a few after I knew people for a long time, but I didn't publish them. I can offer some simple semi-amateur photographs which reveal aspects which journalists never thought to photograph or who were denied access. I have a photograph at a scrapyard. This one, actually no, it's not that one, it's this one here. This is one I staged, the same man that took the picture of me with my folded arms. This is of a gypsy family at a scrapyard. They're looking after the good recyclable metal there. Those are gypsies at work. That was staged, as it were. We went to the site, the scrap site, and we found them. They consented. I'm not saying they staged themselves in the scrapyard, but you don't find anything like that in the journalists' images. They never thought to go to scrapyards or whatever, or dumps. Then I have a photograph which I did take myself of the one gypsy man whose wife trusted me to go out to work with him. Rather dramatically at the scrapyard where he's dealing with the waste, and a rather moving one, just a small one, of his son showing his little sort of 6-year-old buried, as it were. He was learning how to sort out metal. Drawing to an end now. The one image, which of course nobody would understand without the ethnographic knowledge, is one that I took myself. I said, you know, I didn't have a perfect camera. It was on a gypsy site, an older man recycled scrap. What I took was the picture of the tea towel hanging up, showing, I've had to sort of fiddle, put a line there. There was the tea towel. I call it the flag of ethnic purity, showing that the tea towel, wipe your crockery with, has not been washed with the clothes for the human body. That is proof that that family is not polluted. You wouldn't find a journalist taking a photograph of a tea towel. Another one is the same man. And I've got a picture of him in my book turning his back, because I could feel I could publish that. When he saw me with the camera, he was absolutely thrilled, and he said, come out to take a picture of my mare and the new foal. And that was the site. The tea towel was sort of waving in the wind somewhere around there. And he told me to stand in a particular position and said, take that photograph. So I see that is a gypsy's view of his campsite. He instructed me where to stand and click my camera. Yet, ironically, this image was rejected by my publisher, Routledge. The publisher's editor said it was out of focus and did not mean anything, so I excluded it from my book. It's published in my article on Ethnos. To conclude, ethnographic knowledge brings new or counter perspectives to legislators who may publicly favour questionnaire-led quantitative research. Ethnographic knowledge also throws light on outsiders' journalist images with an outsider agenda. Knowledge is also political when set against power without knowledge. The cliché is knowledge is power and the pen is mightier than the sword. We're living in an age when information is seemingly more transmittable and accessible globally than ever. On occasions, the in-depth anthropological knowledge, useful on some occasions for government, may be acceptable only if it is broadly consistent with the current agenda. Knowledge may be rejected, ignored, or misused for mischievous ends. Whatever its truth, it can be discarded when politically embarrassing. in the long run, the rejection of grounded knowledge may produce more problems and conflict than the earlier context. I had the good fortune to witness the transformation of government policy towards nomads by a once flexible Labour government. But with a change of government and the election of Thatcher and her successor, the policy was allowed to drift, resulting in the rejection of the original decisions. A decade after that, the Conservative Party, out of power, their election campaign attempted to whip up public majority anger against the minority. Alas for the gypsies, the new Labour government has failed to return to the policies advised in 1977. Indeed, the new Labour Home Secretary, Jack Straw, in 1999 set a hostile agenda. He said, "Many of these so-called travellers seem to think it's perfectly okay for them to cause mayhem in an area, to go burglaring, thieving, breaking into vehicles, causing all kinds of trouble, including defecating in the doorways of firms and so on and getting away with it." I have no evidence of this. States with ideologies and practices of sedentarism rarely tolerate nomads, but the opportunity to provide for them with minimum conflict in the late 70s was lost. The anthropologist is rendered politically powerless, despite the fact that the discipline has been unjustly criticised for some for being academically detached or the product of the so-called ivory towers. Paradoxically, the power of the text may rest with sympathetic readers beyond the minutiae of opportunistic politicians, but informing the wider polity and giving material for the nomads and their allies. Here I pay homage to Eric Wolfe, who fearlessly used his intellectual talents to reclaim the history and conditions of the often neglected and seemingly powerful. Eric Wolfe, like Hobsbawm, once a resident of Austria, went for grand, sweeping and exciting overviews, drawing on Marx, an exile from his place of birth. In this lecture, I celebrate the power of knowledge based on the minutiae of participant observation, but I defer to the power of Wolfe's theoretical daring. Wolfe's political critique moved beyond knowledge for its own sake, but invited a critical perspective and, for some, invited or inspired activism.
Thank you very much, Judith, for a powerful and wide-ranging analysis. I think I had better open the floor immediately for questions, since there are so many of you here. Before that, perhaps those of you, we have a packed room, those of you who need to leave, perhaps you would like to leave now before we begin the discussion. Let me begin by raising one, perhaps two, obvious point. Judith, in effect, in a world which is increasingly moving towards the sound bite, the information bite, and as you've pointed out using BART, the studium approach to photography, you're really actually arguing for a very old-fashioned approach to study and to knowledge. You're arguing for detail, for comprehensiveness, and, if I may say so, for a great deal of literacy.
So what are you saying? I read books. I mean, yes, I mean, the attention to detail, yes, but I think there's attention to detail in other media things, but it's just so ethnocentric. It's not detail that comes from beyond people's own narrow worldview.
A comment rather than I'm wondering why Cripps used your material,
yes.
Whether it was the fact there was no other material at all, and also he didn't have the time. He mentioned that.
Yes.
So
yes.
What we can do is do the work for which the policy makers or policy analysts do not have the time. But then, of course, you yourself mentioned the question of serendipity in getting your work known and used, and that depends also on the political climate. I wouldn't want to be so dependent on serendipity myself. So I'm trying to think of ways in which I'm an ethnographer, an education ethnographer, ways in which we can sort of second guess policymakers and start doing projects, of course, knowing that we need a lot of time for them, before they're going to need that data. What can we do to be more proactive and sort of, in a way, make our research be advocates before we need to be activists, in a sense? If you have
Well, I find that people do, they do foresee these things. I'm always inspired by, even at undergraduate level, the topics which students choose. They seem to have their ear to the ground in the ways in which the staff don't. And they choose topics that become incredibly important a few years on. I've got two former students, both now professors at Sheffield. One, she did her undergraduate dissertation on childhood, you know, and the stories never end, the grants never end, Alison James. And then Jenny Hockey, she did her dissertation on the inhibited view of death amongst the British English. And she has done whole monographs on views of death now. She's now got huge, rather sort of macabre project on the disposal of ashes from crematoria. But they seem to have puzzled things before. They've got intrigued, and I've noticed just by brief questioning with some of the students here that they're looking at migration, they're looking at Islamic history in Malta, that they are alive to things that the politicians might actually be trying to shelve. So, this was a problem already, because when I said the census was done in 1967, this was a direct result of new legislation in 1960. But up to 1960, gypsies could live on land which they bought or they rented. They lived on land where they paid the landlord, the farmer, and suddenly in 1960 there was a Caravan Sites Act, the first one, which said that everybody in a caravan had to have planning permission. And then there were mass evictions. There were people they took onto the side of the road. There were horrendous police overhauls. People got killed, you know, and that was therefore they had the census. So the government kind of create it, it's sort of circular. But I'll give, my boss, Barbara Adams, she was seconded from the ministry. She was responsible for that first census. So she herself anticipated the problem, although ironically she thought that they all wanted housing and education. I mean, she wrote some of that ethnocentric stuff, you know, and I grant it to her, she did change her mind, but she wrote that ethnocentric patronizing stuff. And when you say Cripps, he was lucky. I mean, the man was very broad-minded, and he didn't just use our work. He really took it seriously. He interviewed gypsy representatives. He went round gypsy sites. He interviewed officials. Those were the days, funny enough, when people of a certain intellectual merit were kind of valued, the great and the good. But even those have been sort of dispensed with now. But so it wasn't just he happened on our, he used our research, and I think he followed it up. It definitely propelled him into those things. But I would say that people have their ear to the ground, and that they do see problems. And I said I'm amazed, always intrigued with undergraduates and masters and PhD topics, that they know where the clouds are forming. And I mean, but it sometimes takes a disaster for it to happen. I mean, when I did that book on gypsies in 1980, published in the early 80s, things went very quiet. There was no research on gypsies throughout the 80s, but it was after the collapse of communism and gypsies becoming the new scapegoat that anthropology students and others, law students, others, they saw the danger signs and they started saying, you know, let's see what's going on. And there's an amazing, incredible body of young postgraduates and postdocs doing work on Roma throughout Europe, and I'm privileged to be able to be in communication with them. So their ear to the ground, that's it. Trust your own instincts.
If I can add a bit to that as well, I think we also have to be careful, as you pointed out, that our research can also be used for, against, so to speak, against the our original aim, if you like, or whatever. And if an issue is about to become a hot issue or is on the way to becoming a hot issue, then whilst, of course, it would be great to get the research done in the hope that it will be used in the right way, so to speak, we have to be aware that by doing the research and maybe through the research exposing or identifying certain vulnerabilities or whatever, that these can actually be used against rather than for.
Yes, absolutely. We had a discussion about that this afternoon in the class, that you you have to be so cautious about what you publish. It just it's quite frightening what can be done. As I said, you know, people who'd studied Vietnam were devastated to find that, you know, military people were reading it to see when the peasants were out in the fields and when they weren't, so to have the most effective bombing. And not to bomb when the people were in their homes, but to bomb when they were out in the fields. I mean, who could have predicted that? Absolutely horrendous. So I, you know, what kind of research are you involved in?
I'm actually a social worker.
Right.
So
yes.
a lecturer rather in social work.
Judith Oakley, thank you very much for leaving us, I think, with a lot of questions, a lot of insights to think about and talk about after you have gone away. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series by Professor Judith Oakley, entitled Ethnographic Knowledge Has the Power to Transform, It May Also Be Ignored, Blogged, or Misappropriated.